Wellness Voyager Radio, self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers, psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager. On the show today, Al Bielek, Philadelphia Experiment. A movie was made about the Philadelphia Experiment. And just to refresh your memory, basically the Navy investigated the idea of optical invisibility and radar invisibility on one of their ships. And it was successful, and that was in the early 1940s. Al Bielek at that time, with his brother, was part of the team that worked on this project. Welcome to the show, Al.
Thank you.
For our listeners, why don't you review that situation?
All right, I'll give them a brief description of what occurred and a little of the history. The basic Philadelphia experiment earned that name because it was in its final phases of test. Took place in the Philadelphia Harbor outside of the Philadelphia Navy Yard, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The history of the experiment actually goes back to 1931, when the earliest paperwork studies and research were done by Dr. Nikola Tesla, Dr. John Hutchinson, the University of Chicago, and a staff physicist there, Dr. Emil Kurtenauer. The project was transferred in 1934 from Chicago, because that was where it originally had its genesis, to the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey. And Tesla went along with it, and Tesla was named the director of the project by then newly elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt, elected President of the United States. He took office March 20th, 1934. And he was the director. There were other people working with him. Dr. John von Neumann, who was a staff mathematician. He came on board in 1933.
Now for the listeners, von Neumann, this is the man who is responsible for the computers.
That is correct. He is a man that invented the modern digital electronic computer, and later, after this project was over. At the time, there were no computers other than the mechanical monstrosities they had later on during the war years in Harvard and MIT, but there were no electronic computers in those days. So von Neumann was on board. Dr. Einstein was already there. He was sort of an overseer of all the projects at the Institute, and in those days there were a lot.
The reason that we don't know this is because this was a classified...
At that point, it was not classified.
Oh, it wasn't classified.
Not then. It was a feasibility study. It was funded by the Navy with research money. And in 1936, they had the first semi-successful test in the Institute grounds. The Institute was on the grounds of the Princeton University, but was a totally separate entity. Went on so that in 1940, after a lot more work and study, they had a fully successful test in the Brooklyn Navy Yard of a small tender. It became optically invisible. Of course, in those days, they weren't concerned about radar. We had yet to have any really good radar. 3 years made an enormous difference. I and my brother came on board after completing our schooling, PhDs in physics. I had Harvard, he at the University of Edinburgh in Edinburgh, Scotland. We enlisted in the Navy in 1939, September. Her father, who was a career naval person, an officer in the later days of his career, that was Captain Cameron, though he went under the name of Arnold because he was raised by Auntie Arnold from the age of five on, so he used the name Arnold. But he arranged everything for us. We enlisted in the Navy, were given commissions, spent 90 days in a special training school at Providence, Rhode Island, and then were shipped down to New Jersey and became part of the project at Princeton at the Institute. We were then instructed in the real physics and what was really going on. Our purpose with the Navy was to write technical reports and assist in the project any way we could. But at that point, later on in the year, they had a successful test. The Navy then classified the entire project, called a Project Rainbow. Project went on from that point. Roosevelt was elated, gave Tesla a battleship to make invisible. And he sabotaged that test in March of 42 because he became aware of the fact there would be very serious personnel problems with the extremely high-powered equipment they were using. Very high-powered RF transmission.
Now, just for a moment, I want to interrupt and just say for those listeners who may have just tuned in, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager, and we are listening to Al Bielek. He is a survivor of the Philadelphia Experiment, which was an experiment to make a battleship radar and optically invisible, and was successful, finally.
Because of the very high-powered RF equipment and magnetic coils with the magnetic drives for them on the deck of the ship, he was certain there would be serious personnel problems, possibly some dead Navy personnel.
So Tesla foresaw the idea that there was going to be a problem with human beings.
That's correct. He foresaw it very well. He went to the Navy for more time, and of course, at that point, we had been out for a year going around the Pacific in the USS Pennsylvania by orders for the Navy, and when you're in the Navy, you do what they tell you. So we were out to sea for a year and came back in January of 42 and found the test well underway for the test on the battleship in March of 42, and he begged the Navy for more time to solve the personnel problem. He was told, no way, you have a date, do what you have to do, but there's a war on, meet the test date. Well, he sabotaged the test. He detuned the equipment so that when everything was turned on, nothing happened. And consequently, there was no problem. So he bowed out, and von Neumann took over. And von Neumann decided he wanted to change the approach and also have a ship built from the ground up for the test. So in July of 42, he went to the drawing boards, selected a number called DE-173, which later was named the Eldridge. And they made modifications to install the very heavy generators and other equipment in the hold of the ship. Came down the ways in September of 42, went into dry dock, was outfitted with heavy equipment, then was dockside in December of 42, where the rest of the electronics was put on board. In the meantime, we were trained in not only the physics, what they were trying to do, but also in the operation of the equipment and the sequences that had to be involved in turning on the equipment and what to do if something went wrong. As I said, there were no computers in those days. Everything had to be operated manually, and it took two of us, my brother and myself, to do it.
Okay, now just to straighten out things for people, we're going to clear up this name situation because in the particular scenario here, you are the Cameron brothers.
That's correct.
And we're going to explain later on why you are now known as Al Bielek.
All right, so we were trained for that, and after they finally had all equipment on board and went through many tests, about March of 43, von Neumann became very shaky about the idea of probable personnel problems due to the very high power, and he was then using a pulsed system, totally different than what Tesla was using. He used a continuous wave analog system. With high power pulses, you have much more exposure to possible damage to the nervous system. So he decided to make some changes. They had a generator. It was totally unsuccessful, and he removed it after one technician who was assigned to us was zapped and wound up in the hospital in a coma. Later was released with a medical discharge. He did recover. So by July of 43, they were ready for the tests.
Now, did you have reservations at this point?
Not in July for the first test. We did most definitely for the second test.
Okay, why don't we go to the second test?
All right, first test was July 22nd, 43. They had personnel problems, but nothing totally outrageous.
Now, was there actual invisibility?
Yes, there was total invisibility, radar and optical. By 43, we had very good radar. There was a lot of rapid development. Now, for the second test, von Neumann begged the Navy for further time to correct the problems. They said, no, you do what you have to do, but you have a drop-dead date of the 12th of August, 1940.
Now, that's an important date. We're not going to tell everybody at this point, but they should remember that. Also, it's interesting to note that now von Neumann must have come up with the same conclusions that Tesla had come up with.
Yes, he did. And he was trying to get more time in order to correct the problem since they now had absolute evidence they had a problem from the first test.
So the problem basically was going to be, and turned out to be, that while you could make something optically invisible, what occurs had a tremendous effect or a very negative effect on human beings.
That's correct. Affected the nervous system and the mind and caused severe problems. In the case of the first test, they were temporary. But in the final test on the 12th of August, as we did go ahead with the test, everyone was nervous beforehand. Von Neumann was nervous. My brother and I standing on the decks of the Eldridge in the harbor just prior to the orders to turn on the equipment and proceed with the test were very apprehensive about what might happen. We received the orders, fired up the equipment in proper sequence, And to outside observers that fateful day, it appeared like it was successful. They had full radar and visibility. And as the Navy had ordered a slight change, they did not want optical invisibility anymore at that point. Because you must remember in those days, there was no lower end, no shore end, no long-range navigation systems, no satellites. They were totally dependent on optical viewing if there was no radar. So they decided to leave the optical part alone so we can see the ship.
Okay, that was their choice, but that's not what happened, right?
No, that's not what happened. For about the first 70 seconds, everything seemed normal. It went on for almost 2 minutes. And then all of a sudden, there was a blue flash of light, and the ship, which was radar invisible, but still visible through a haze, disappeared, haze and all, and was gone. Gone for 4 hours, came back about 4 hours later with damage to the superstructure. One of the special antenna masts was broken, and there was no radio response. They sent a launch out, boarded the ship, and found then that there were sailors dying all over the place. Two were buried in a steel deck, two were buried in a steel bulkhead. A fifth man had a hand buried in a bulkhead.
Yeah, let's make this clear to the listeners. What had happened was that these particular sailors were, parts of their body were actually embedded in the steel.
Correct. Hopelessly embedded, molecularly bound to the steel, so there was no way one could save them. They all died, of course, and funeral afterwards involved taking a cutting torch and cutting out the steel plates and burying the bodies, plates and all. Rather a gruesome experience because I was involved in the burial detail. And the fifth man lived, but the other problem was those who were stationed on deck deliberately, which they did in both tests as observers, were all insane. One or two had the problem of what they called the burning fire, which did not consume the body. And two others disappeared.
Maybe you could tell us more about that burning.
Well, if you go back to your Bible, to describe in the days of Moses of the burning bush that was on fire and could be seen to be burning, but it was not consumed. The fire kept going, but the bush was not destroyed or harmed in any way. The same thing happened to a number of sailors. They caught fire, and the flames were coming out of their bodies, but the body was not consumed.
Now, what was going on? Were they feeling pain?
No, apparently they felt nothing.
But obviously they couldn't go anywhere because wherever they went would catch on fire?
That's right, but no, nothing else caught fire.
This is interesting.
They didn't even move. They were frozen at the spot.
Oh, I see.
They were literally frozen physically when that occurred. It took a great deal of time and trouble to correct that problem. The Navy spent a fortune on it, and they also found the laying on of hands of other sailors seemed to help the problem and cause the fire to go out, but it would reappear periodically.
I see.
Those people were transferred off, and many of them wound up in the funny farm, some in special hospitals for the rest of their lives. Those who were below decks were unaffected because of the steel shielding them from both the magnetic fields and the RF fields.
All right, let me remind everyone that this is Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager, and we're having an incredible interview today with Al Bielek, survivor of the Philadelphia Experiment. And incidentally, if you're interested in actually seeing a dramatic presentation of this incident, it's called The Philadelphia Experiment. And that has a history of its own. I'd like to touch on that later on.
Yes. The movie is not 100% accurate, but it's close enough that it will give you a very good and rather grim idea of what happened, including the underground base of the Phoenix Project, which it locked into.
Okay, let's continue then. Now, what happened to you and your brother?
Right, we were on board the ship.
Yeah, we've covered for this moment how things seemed to the observers.
Correct.
Namely, that this all occurred within a four-hour period. But let's tell our listeners now, real quickly, what happened to you and your brother.
All right. We, of course, had turned on the equipment, and for about 30 seconds, things seemed to be normal, operating as expected. Then we started to get funny waverings of the banks and banks of electron tubes used to drive the field coils of the two generators. And then we started to get something else. There was huge electrical arcs taking place inside the control room, which was totally unprecedented, not expected, and no explanation for them. So we decided something was drastically wrong. We could not raise anyone by radio at that point, so we had our own emergency instructions, which were, of course, to shut down the equipment. So we went to grab the main handles for the main power, and no matter how hard we yanked on them, they wouldn't budge. We could not shut the power off. So at that point, we decided things were getting even worse, further out of control. We decided we better get out of there, open the bulkhead door, ran out on deck, saw people running around, milling around, totally out of it. But no one at that point was buried in the decks. We got the bright idea, well, let's jump overboard and swim ashore. So we jumped overboard. But we couldn't see shore. We couldn't see anything beyond the railing. So we jumped overboard and wound up falling and falling and falling. We eventually wound up with our feet on dry land at night, and which happened to be, as we found out later, the inside perimeter of a military base that was at Montauk, Long Island. At the extreme eastern tip, there is a military base there. It's now abandoned, of course, but at that time it was still active. And in 83, which as we found out, it was still going.
Okay, and the year, which is interesting to our listeners, you left in 1943.
And wound up on the 12th of August in 1983 at night, as we found out later, because MPs grabbed us, took us to a building, put us on an elevator, and took us down several levels in the underground. The elevator door opened, and we were met by an elderly civilian. There was obviously other people all over the place. And the man says, well, gentlemen, we've been waiting for you. I'm Dr. Van Neumann. We looked at him and says, you're who? And he says, I am Dr. Van Neumann. We said, you can't be. We left him an hour ago. He was much younger. He says, I'm sorry, I am the same man. You're no longer in 43. You're now in 1983, and I'm 40 years older. He did convince us by giving us the grand tour of the place. And then, of course, after we saw all the modern electronic marvels, which were unknown in 43, we had a little choice but to accept the fact we were no longer in 43.
Right, because they had color television and all kinds of things.
Right. Graphic displays, huge computers, color television, and of course, if you watch TV for a few hours, and we did have the opportunity to watch for a few hours, we see jet aircraft, all kinds of modern conveniences and modern devices, which were totally unknown in 43. In any case, they told us they would have to send us back to the elders to smash the equipment.
Now, that's an important point. Why did you have to do that?
Because the two experiments locked up and created an artificial hyperspace bubble which sucked the Eldridge into it. And the Eldridge was powered with its own equipment with a huge diesel electric generator in the hold and had enough fuel to keep it running for about 30 days. He says, we cannot control it from here. He says, you have to go back and shut the equipment off because the hyperspace bubble will continue to grow. If you don't, we have no idea what will happen.
Now, in the movie, they actually talk about the weather changes that were going on in Long Island in that particular point.
Is that actually true? There were severe weather problems in Long Island, but in the movie they did not show the terminal as being Long Island. They showed it as being at Wendover Air Force Base, Wendover, Utah. The reason that they shot there rather than Long Island is because the U.S. government would not allow EMI Thorne with their crews to film at Long Island, which they wanted to do. They knew that that was where the other terminal was, and of course, in 83, it was still running until after August 12th. And so they were not allowed to shoot there, so they went to Wendover Air Force Base in Utah and shot it there. I know those buildings, as I've been out in Wendover many times. And that was the terminal. They simulated the underground in the movie quite accurately. And thereupon, they did show severe weather problems. Long Island did have severe weather problems in the process of the various tests that were run on the Phoenix Project prior to this final one. So the problems with the weather were well known. But the problem that they were developing is much beyond weather. And they were concerned with a hyperspace bubble that could engulf part of the Earth and cause other serious problems. There are still more problems which we can relate after we finish this little scenario. What happened was they sent us back to the decks of the Utters because the Phoenix Project was quite capable of sending an object or a person anywhere in space and time, and it was no problem to send us back 40 years to a slightly different location. They were able to track where the Eldridge was in the hyperspace bubble because they were masters of doing this by that time. So we sent us to the Eldridge, we landed on the decks, and we went and grabbed axes and smashed the equipment. And the equipment was sufficiently destroyed. We could hear the generators winding down. We knew it was only a matter of a few minutes before the fuels collapsed. They did eventually, and of course, the Eldridge returned to its location in the harbor in 43 for technical reasons I won't go into right now.
So, but the point here that I think our listeners need to understand is that the reason it returned in 4 hours was because you were sent back to stop the thing from happening.
Yes. And why the four-hour gap, we still can't explain, other than to say that one you are in hyperspace, or the ship and the crew are in hyperspace, there is no time relationship whatsoever with the reality which we know. There is no way of measuring or gauging time there.
It would have been interesting if you'd come back before the experiment started.
Well, you raise a good interesting point there, but it wasn't too likely because this would violate certain of the basic precepts of time. But that's a very interesting thought. In any case, it returned, and at that point, as the fields were collapsing, my brother, for reasons we're still arguing and still have not resolved completely, jumped overboard and returned to the future. And we in 43 never saw him again. I stayed with the equipment.
So you elected to stay in 43, and he elected to return to 83.
I don't know if it was a matter of him electing to return to 83. We have yet to fully resolve that issue. I decided, of course, to stay there with the ship, and I was expecting him to stay with me. It was his idea suddenly to take off and jump over the side of the ship again, and he did it just before the fields collapsed. He did return, actually not to the same point in 83, but as we found out since, to very late 82, probably around Christmas, New Year's of 82.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to move away from this, let people go out and watch the movie if they want to,
oh, yes,
because we've got some very interesting things to talk about.
Correct.
The first thing I'd like to start with is this. I would like to just for a moment touch on something that has probably not been touched on that often. Let's talk about the movie itself.
All right.
Why did EMI elect to do this movie, or what is your understanding about this now?
Well, my understanding is still a bit incomplete. I tried to contact the people who were involved in it, and I know exactly who the producer is. He happens to be an American, but he is something of a recluse and very hard to locate.
Now, for listeners, it's interesting to note that the movie actually was not allowed to show in the United States.
That's correct. The history is interesting. They shot during 83 and 84 and set their release dates for August of 84 in about six different cities in the U.S. simultaneously.
Once again, they chose that time, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
Right. Yeah, they went on and released their date, and then they, 3 days before the final showing, the release date for the initial showing, the premiere showing, they received a letter from the United States government saying, we do not want this movie shown in the United States. Now, EMI Thorne is a British organization, not American. If it had been an American organization, it would never probably have gotten the film in the first place, because the government would have exerted enormous pressure. But they couldn't stop a British firm from filming. What they did do is they told them, we don't want it shown in the U.S. They didn't care about anywhere else. And EMI Thorne decided the only thing they could do at that point was ignore the letter and go ahead and release the movie, which they did. It was shown in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sedona, Arizona, Philadelphia, of course. I understand that people lined up around the block there to see it. And then a few days later, they got another letter from the government, which says, you will not show this movie in the United States. So EMI Thorne could not ignore the second letter and fired back at them and says, well, if you want to stop the showing this, you will have to get a federal court order. And the government, whoever was involved in this correspondence, says, we will. And they did. 2 weeks after its release, it was banned for showing in the United States by a federal court injunction. This injunction held for 2 years. EMI Thorne finally had it released with a counter injunction in 86. Precisely when, I don't know. But it was released, and then they released the video, which has been available in the U.S. at the video stores ever since. It's never been shown in the movie house since, to my knowledge, but of course it's been on HBO and many of the other movie groupings and the various production companies in television. HBO is not the only one that's shown it. But it's been shown on TV on a rather regular basis ever since. Now, the strange part of the history of this thing is they knew accurately the first part and the ending part, and a friend of mine, named Preston Nichols in Long Island, was visited by the then archives director for EMI Thorne, who says, yeah, we know what the history was. We've had it in our archives for quite some time. Find it hard to believe what he said, but in any case, he says, we had to add certain things to it, you know.
Okay, so now here's
the chase and a few other things to make a good movie.
The point here being that they had in their archives the entire scenario before 1983.
That's correct.
Which would have been when we would supposedly find out about it in hindsight.
Yep.
All right.
They had it, and I almost had contact with one of the people working for me, EMI Thorne, when I was lecturing last fall in Canada, in Montreal, Quebec. Saturday afternoon, a person came forward from the back audience. I saw him starting to head towards me on the stage. I was distracted answering a question on stage, and I look up, and the next thing I see, this gentleman is going out the back door, accompanied by four or five other people. I thought it was very strange, but I didn't connect anything unusual about it at that point. When I returned to New York, Preston Nichols told me this very interesting story. He says, guess who I got a phone call from Sunday morning? He says, I don't know. He says, Chuck, he used a pseudonym, but his real name is Charles Hamill, brother to Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill, of course, well-known movie actor. Chuck Hamill had a career in the past in the U.S. as being a rock movie, a rock singer and performer with rock bands under a pseudonym, Peter Knight. And eventually left the U.S. and went to England and allegedly became part of the M.I. Thorne organization and did a number of other things. He was apparently a very good musical composer. But he came over to see me directly when he heard there was going to be a lecture by me in Montreal, because being a British citizen in recent years, there was no problem whatever to go to Canada. He didn't need a passport, just hop on a plane and go over. He told a story that afternoon, when he started to come forward to see me, he was grabbed by four U.S. government agents, escorted back to his hotel. They sat him down there and it said to him, as he quoted it, if you ever make any attempt to see Al Bielek again, we will kill you, period. At which point he changed hotels and called Preston Nichols Sunday morning and told him that story. And Preston told me the story by relay when I came home Monday. And I've never seen him. I've not been able to locate him or contact him to verify this.
Now, is there any possibility? I mean, do you have any hypothesis on this at all? Or
I'm sorry?
Do you have an assumption on this at all, or why this occurred?
Yes, he knew me, and he insisted to Preston that he knew me, and he wanted to see me. I said, well, the name means nothing to me. I said, show me some pictures if you have any of them. He says, yes, show me a picture from a CD made back in the 60s. I said, I don't recognize that as anyone I know. And he went back in his own private photo album back to an earlier stage and pulled a picture out when Chuck was about 18. I says, you stop there. That person I recognize. I says, I can't tell you why. I have no idea why, but yes, I do know him. He says, who is that? He says, that's Chuck Hamill. So I've yet to meet him and find out what really happened and the whole story. But he did make comment about the same records in the archives, and he says they were buried so deep nobody would ever find them.
Now, a lot of this is going to make a lot of sense to our listeners as we go along, because we're going to start talking about what actually happened to you as in order to keep you from telling the story that you're now telling. And incidentally, for our listeners, when you have not always been aware of this incident either. I mean, you're rather new on this yourself.
That's quite correct. My memories of the Philadelphia experiment for the last... to come back, the Phoenix Project memories came back in May of 86 when I was on Long Island, as I did go back there to visit several times, and then when moved back there in August of 86 to work, eventually for work had to return to Phoenix, and that was in 87.
Now, while you were not affected necessarily by the time lock, from my understanding and from lectures that I've heard you talk about, you were actually, let's say, Well, I'll say brainwashed for right now. We have talked about some really strange stuff. We're just going to continue right now. Al, let's continue.
Okay. Now, there is, of course, the problem of how to resolve the fact that I was born Edward Cameron and now Al Bielek. I was the Philadelphia experiment. We'll not get into the Phoenix Project yet. The Philadelphia experiment was declared a total failure in late 43.
Yeah, let's just for our listeners, because you know this so well, they may be having trouble. The Philadelphia experiment is 1943. The Phoenix Project was 1983.
It was actually earlier. It ran from the late 60s, early 70s on through 83. And there were many phases and different aspects of it. But the important aspect was the last one, which was from about 75 to 83, and the way it locked up to the Philadelphia experiment. That requires a little explaining as to why.
All right, let's start with why you have different names.
Right. Now, I remained in the Navy. The project was scrubbed. That is, the Philadelphia experiment was scrubbed by the Navy in 43. I remained with the Navy. Eventually, of course, it didn't take very long. Dr. von Neumann, being the genius he was and was much sought after, became part of the atomic bomb project at Los Alamos, which is well known as public record. And he was there unknowns to me at this point, and going backwards to investigate, he was not there continuously, but was a consultant that went in 6 or 8 weeks at a time. Now, at some point in 44, he made the suggestion to me, would you like to come up and work with me at Los Alamos? And I said, sure, I'm doing nothing here where I am. The Navy was delighted because they wanted to get me out of sight, so to speak. And at that point, they were not into murdering officers or brainwashing them yet.
Now, you at this moment, you personally didn't feel like you presented a problem to them.
I did present a problem to them.
Oh, you did?
I knew the entire workings of the experiment. My brother was disappeared and missing and never seen again, so far as anybody knew.
So were you talking? I mean, were you kind of
I was talking some, but of course I was bound by security, by secrecy. But then within the Navy, with other people who had the same classification level, it's very hard to stop talk. And the story of the experiment was already throughout the entire fleet. The scuttlebutt gets around very fast, believe me. And that's at enlisted level as well as officers. And among officers, it goes even faster because they seem to be a little less bound by the feelings of secrecy. And, of course, they tell each other in secret, naturally. Whatever, I became part of the Los Alamos project. I did various things for the Navy, mostly writing reports. And after I was digging in their vaults and learning perhaps too much about other projects that were going on, because that was such a secret place in the 40s, that they buried all the most secret projects in the U.S. in the vaults up there at Los Alamos because nobody knew it existed, except the people who were there and a few people in Washington. In 47, they decided I knew too much, and I was arrested on charges of espionage. I was already married and had a son, and that part of the movie is correct, by the way. I did have a pregnant girlfriend, and we had been living up there. I was taken one day from lunch by the MPs, arrested, which I said, on what charge? I said, espionage, and it took me away from the family, left them there, never saw them again, and in handcuffs to the famous little Navy buses, and then to the railroad station, and to Washington, D.C.
Now, you were arrested as Cameron.
As Edward Cameron.
Edward Cameron.
Lieutenant Commander Edward Cameron. I expected a full military court-martial. There was no court-martial. Charges were dropped. I stayed in Washington approximately another 10 days, as I now remember. And then suddenly the orders came. I was to go to Long Island. And they took me up to Long Island to what was then a fully operational military base known as Fort Hero, on the extreme eastern tip of Long Island. It was an Army base and also a Navy base. The Navy had submarine pens there and certain other interests. In any case, I was taken there. I was put in a specific location, which you would have to see the photos of. I know the whole story of the Phoenix Project to understand, but it was taken to this one point, surrounded by military personnel, in the middle of a circle with a roadway around it, a grass circle, and said, stand there, don't move. So I did. I had about 50 guns trained on me. I didn't move. Suddenly, I wasn't there. I was back in 1983 at Montauk. And I was, again, met by Dr. Van Neumann. He was almost in tears. He says, I don't like what's going to happen to you. I have nothing to do with this. I have nothing to say. I have no authority to stop it.
Okay, so at this point, the thing that our listeners need to, it's hard to follow this, you know,
yes.
Real quickly. But what's happened here is that you were pushed forward into time then.
I was pulled back by the Montauk Project. See, they can pick somebody up in the past or the future and bring them into the what we would call a Montauk station.
All right. Yeah, you need a willing suspension of disbelief, folks. Let's go ahead with this thing.
Right. So they told me, he says, they're going to totally brainwash you, do an age regression on you, and put you back in another family where you will develop a new identity. He says, I can't stop it. He says, there's nothing I can do. He was no longer the director of the project. He was there merely as a consultant from 77 to 83. In any case, they did do that. They first, in some very exotic equipment, which I do remember, looked like large plastic tubes, large enough to put a standard medical gurney in the middle of it with me strapped down to it. And in the thing, closed the door, and there was double-walled plastic of some type, or looked like plastic, with many coils in it connected to large banks of electronic apparatus lining the wall adjacent. They turned the equipment on, and suddenly all the memories were gone, and just like some people report in a strange state of reverie, you're aware of your being, but if nothing else. And then the next thing I remembered, I was sitting on the piano next to a miniature Christmas tree. I was about a year old, approximately. The family, as I know, or that is while they were alive, and there was the Beelix and the Heckles and the Kirches and everybody else were there for a Christmas. From that point on, my memories were essentially intact as Al Beelick all the way up to the present. And that was how they did it. They physically regressed me in terms of age and body size. Believe it or not, they're capable of doing this in that equipment. So they shrank me down to a size of a one-year-old baby. No memories. So I grew up like a brand new kid, like I knew nothing.
Born then at that particular time?
I just been born, and normal growth, normal kid problems, and all of this. The only exception being, as a teenager, I would have fleeting memories which would suddenly run through my head. Oh, it was like an alien language. Well, the math I knew was like an alien language, all right. I would have memories of equations and things, and it'd last about a second or two, and then suddenly the whole thing was wiped out. And the only thing I had was a wispy memory of, well, I remembered something. I wonder what it was. This went on repeatedly in my teenage years. Then I went to the Navy again. I was an electronic technician for a year, and then came out. And
So back into the Navy?
Yes, I went back in the Navy again, believe it or not. And in the late 40s, I started college. I had a business of my own going, which eventually failed. And I went back to college in New Jersey, and then after that, I went to UCLA in Los Angeles. I had a degree, and then I only went to a bachelor's, nothing beyond. And from 58 until 88, I was a consulting electronic engineer. I had worked prior to that as a technician, but I was an engineer. I started out as a consultant and remained essentially that for 30 years. 1988, I retired because I couldn't get any more work. In 86, I recovered the memories of the Phoenix Project, and then in January of 88, the memories of the Philadelphia experiment by watching the very movie I had described, done by E.M.I. Thorne, one late night in January of 88. Now, the Phoenix Project must be described briefly. We could go on for hours with this thing, but I won't.
And we are talking to Al Beelick, survivor of the Philadelphia experiment.
All right. Now, as Al Beelick, I was eventually tapped on the shoulder by the government to do some other secret work. And I was, again, totally unaware of this because in the late 50s, early 60s, they developed the hardware where you could quite literally split the right brain and left brain into two separate memory banks, essentially the same personality covering both, but the memories were isolated. You could have a normal daytime career, and you could have a separate career in some secret government project, and one never knew what the other was doing. One never knew that the other existed. In some such manner, they acquired my services, and I became involved with the Phoenix Project on a continuing basis from sometime in the 70s, because in 1973, I will bypass the first two phases, but the final phase is the one of importance. They were working on the time project, the time tunnels, which was a continuation of work done by the Nazis in World War II in Germany. They had a working time machine in 1945, believe it or not. All of that work was transferred to the U.S. before the war ended and after both. The project at Montauk, which was called the Phoenix Project, highly classified, concerned itself in the phase I'm now describing with the development of a system for not only time travel, but tunnels through space and time, a la Carl Sagan and his wormholes in space and time. They did it exactly as he described it. I don't know which came first, the project or his book, but in any case, they did what he described.
And it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah. And because of that, they were able to go anywhere in time and space. And I was working on that project as Al Beelick, as was Duncan Cameron. Now, what happened to Duncan Cameron? This is very important. He went back, as I said, to late 82, early 83. He worked on the Phoenix Project for a while as Duncan the First.
Now, Duncan was your brother, for those
yes.
of you who are listening.
He was my brother both times, because the same father was sired him both times. And as Duncan the First, in the original body that was on the Eldridge, he was there for a short period of time. Something happened, and he lost, as we say, his time locks, and he aged extremely rapidly. He was in the process of dying. It was arranged because in the Phoenix Project was heavily invested with aliens and alien technology they transferred his soul to another body, which happened to be another body created by the same father, Alexander Duncan Cameron Sr., with his fifth wife.
Okay, now alien, we're talking about extraterrestrials.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And he was a walk-in to the body, which was born in 1951 with a surrogate soul, and in 63 he walked into that body as the original Duncan in a new body, Duncan the Second, but the same soul. And he also became part of the Phoenix Project. So we both worked on it under his new body with the same name, and I in the old body, new name.
Now you must have had a very expanded understanding of living at this point.
Any case, we were part of the project, and I was involved with it for quite a number of years, up until the final days and the final ending on the 12th of August, 1983. I was not there at the final collapse. Duncan was. And when the project crashed, of course, they finally gave all of us our final debriefings in January through March of 84, which means you don't remember this project, do you? They give you the appropriate treatment, so you don't remember the project, but that treatment didn't hold very well, because by 86 we were remembering the Phoenix Project. All we had to do was go out in eastern Long Island to the old site. The fields, the vibes, the residual electronic fields were so heavy that even people with absolutely no metaphysical or occult sensitivity wander out in the main radar tower and they want to know what the blazes ever went on in here. It hit them. Park rangers couldn't even stand being in that building, much less a sensitive.
Okay, now we're gonna kind of jump around a little bit because we've got a lot of things I would like
right.
to cover. Let's talk for a moment about the time lock, and let's explain to the listeners
right.
what this is about.
The time lock is a metaphysical, physiological thing which occurs at the point of conception of a new body. Everybody, of course, knows what happens at conception physically. But at the time of conception metaphysically, a soul is attached to that growing embryo, and there is a lock on it, which provides also, because of the nature of the mechanism, which I do not fully understand, a time lock. This means the soul is locked at that point in the flow of time as a reference point.
So it's in our understanding of linear time.
Correct.
Because up until then, there is no time.
Correct. Soul floating around free can or cannot, as it chooses, remain in a particular point in time. It can go forward or backwards, and sometimes does. But when it chooses another body, or it is chosen for him, as the case may be, they are locked to that embryo, and they're then locked to that reference point in the stream of time, and they flow with the normal flow of time in our physical reality as we know it, become part of that body as it's born, and are locked to it.
Now, this is what gives a person continuity.
This gives a person continuity in our existence, correct.
And this is the very thing that we had problems with in the experiment, right?
That is right. Those time locks were blown loose because of the extreme power of the equipment in the fields on those people on deck, and they floated loose. The references were gone. Some disappeared altogether, and the others drifted. And if they were unfortunate enough to rematerialize as the ship rematerialized in our reality in a different location than where they had been standing and happened to be at the same point where the steel of the ship rematerialized as their body rematerialized, and they were locked to the molecules of steel and the steel to their body, and there was no hope for them.
Hmm.
That was because they lost their time locks. Those down below deck did not.
All right, let's jump a little bit.
With the time lock, you lock to the stream of time. If something happens that those time locks are broken, and you start to drift, and that means your body also, not just the soul. The soul is locked to the body, both can drift. And when two things can happen, you can theoretically drift out of that time frame, or the body can start, because the references are lost, they can age very rapidly or get younger very rapidly. Both cases have been reported. But in Duncan's case, he aged extreme rapidity, about a year an hour, and they found a new body for him because he had to be kept alive in a physical body along with myself. And that gets into the other aspects of this problem. And the other aspect of this problem was that in creating this 40-year-wide rift in the fabric of time, which is what they did with the two experiments locking up, and it was not an accident, it was deliberate.
Yeah, let's talk quickly about the time. 1943, 1983, August 12th.
In creating that rift in time, you create a phenomena very much like the standing waves in an RF transmission line. Actually, gravity flows in waves. Time can also flow in a wave function, though normally it does not. But when you create that type of disruption, according to Norman Levinson, who was the man who developed the time equations and the time matrix, you can create an unstable condition where, very much like RF in a transmission line that's not properly damped, that you can have a forward wave and you can have a reverse wave. Now, if you get the forward wave of time, that's the normal one. But if you develop, because of those two rifts at the 4383 ends, you develop a reverse time wave, and that reverse time wave should go back and hit the 63 point, which is again is another reference point established by Earth's resonance and its own biorhythms. If the forward and reverse time waves hit that same point, we would, and had done so, they were going to do it, but except countermeasures were taken. If those two hit at the 63 reference point, do you have any idea what it would have done?
I hope you're not asking me, because I don't know.
Okay, well, I'm saying this to your listening audience.
Right.
It would have ripped the tectonic plates in the North American continent loose. It would have destroyed the top 500 to 700 feet of the Earth's structure and put North American continent largely under ocean water. Now, this obviously did not happen. But it did not happen because Dr. Van Neumann knew the potential was there for this to happen, and he assembled a group of scientists, four total, including himself. I will leave names and such out. Two came out of the future, and two came from what was then considered more or less present time, and they all went back to 63, built some special equipment, and by being at the right point at the right time, they damped this thing down to prevent the surge of the reverse time wave, and there was no such problem.
We are hearing about the future, the past, and the present.
They all came together in 1963, and they were...
Right. With Al Bielek.
It did not cause a disaster.
Yeah.
It would have been a colossal disaster if it happened.
So you met with these senior scientists recently?
Dr. Van Neumann, of course, was the one who organized it. I have met with at least two of the others. I will not give names for very obvious reasons. And one of them, at least, in fact, two of them, did impart the information as to what would have happened had they not been on this project.
Now, we're running out of a little time, so let's talk a little bit about the Honolulu phenomena, which you've just heard about very recently.
All right. Many people may ask, whatever happened to the Philadelphia experiment? It was resurrected. They did solve the problems in 1953, what Dr. Van Neumann did with a new system and a computer, which he developed himself, and went through many generations of equipment so that today the Navy, the Air Force, whomever, has available to them invisibility equipment, much smaller than the original by far, and they can put it on aircraft. They have the systems on the B-1, they have it on the B-2 stealth bomber, and it obviously can be installed in other aircraft because it's now much smaller than it used to be. In the last week, I received a phone call from a radio station in Honolulu, and the man there, I'd have to look up his name at the moment, it was a Mr. Wainwright, on one of the stations there in Honolulu, called and asked me what I knew about the phone calls and the call-ins they've been receiving from residents in Honolulu, particularly along Waikiki Beach, who had been reporting repeatedly flights of Navy aircraft, not single aircraft, but a complete squadron, four or more at a time, flying along the beach. They hear them, they see them, they fly into a cloud bank, and they never come out of the cloud bank, but the sound does. And this has been happening on a repeated basis.
So the sound of the jet comes out of the cloud bank, but they cannot see a jet.
Correct. And several at a time. I mean, these were flying in formation. And probably singular also, but it's been happening over a period of time, and they call the station, what's going on? So he found my phone number and called me. And very simply, they have the invisibility equipment, and they're using it. Now, they do it in the cloud bank for a very simple reason. The person doesn't see the plane blink out. They go into a cloud bank, and they can assume that, well, they went in another direction, I didn't see it, well, it's probably they're all right, and so forth. They don't have visual proof that they actually have the equipment. They pull it inside a cloud bank. They have it.
Okay, Al, we're running out of time. Just a few things. All of this information that you've given us today has been based on something that I think we just touched on quickly. We've got about 2 minutes. Let's talk about extraterrestrial influence.
Okay. There was none directly involved in the Philadelphia experiment, but it was very heavily involved in the Phoenix project. It was part of the operation. We had several types of extraterrestrial. Most of them were the reptilian types from Orion Confederation. The Draconians, the Orions. We had some Syrians from the Syrian group who were not reptilian. They all had, including the Leverons, which is a fourth, they all had the technology for doing what we could not do. We could build a time machine. We could not build a device which would go through space and time simultaneously. They provided us with the technology. They were using this program to their own ends. And had the station remained functional, probably would have still been using it to their own ends. Their goal was to create this 40-year-wide rift in time, in space-time, really, for their own ends, which was to get a large invasion fleet in to planet Earth, coming from, I believe, Zeta Reticuli, containing large, large numbers of Greys. Up to that point, there were very few here, but they arrived in large numbers in 54, and Eisenhower, then president, of course, was forced to sign an agreement. They controlled the project. They gave us the technology. There were other things we gave them. No government money, whatever, was spent on the Phoenix project. This was privately funded, believe it or not, by Nazi gold from 1944, which was put in hiding until 54, about $100 billion plus worth.
So the point here is that we're hearing once again from another source that there is an extraterrestrial group living here on the planet, working in coordination with our own government.
Correct. A secret element of the government. The general political government does not know, with the exception, of course, of the president, because he was former director of the CIA. All the intelligence agencies know. And there's one investigation mounted here from Phoenix by Senator Goldwater some years ago when he was still senator and head of the Armed Services Oversight Committee. You could find no trace of government money or no reports. Nobody in the political government and most of the military knew nothing whatever about the Phoenix Project. It was a deep, dark secret until it was brought to his attention, and then they started massive investigations and finally unearthed it.
Thank you, Al, for being on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be part of it.
This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager, and I want to thank all of you for tuning in to Timeless Voyager. I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one. Thank you.